Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Zaji Cox, author of the new book, Plums for Months, a memoir of nature and neurodivergence from Portland's Forest Avenue Press. Zaji's been writing fiction since her first short story at the age of 9. She went on to self-publish a fantasy adventure novel, Journey into Argyrelia, in 2011 when she was 13, and another self-published work, the story collection Musings, in 2016. Her work has appeared in Pathos Literary Magazine, Entropy Magazine, the Portland Metro Zine, and Cultural Daily, among others, and she's a contributor to the anthology 2020, The Year of the Asterisk, from University of Hell Press. Plums for Months is a memoir and brief essays of Zaji's childhood, moving from the desert of New Mexico to the rain and greenery of Portland, Oregon. We follow Zaji as she adapts to her new home, her challenges growing up mixed race and neurodivergent, her years as a competitive gymnast, then as a dancer, and always as a writer of both prose and poetry. In the words of author Lydia Yuknovich, Zaji Cox has given the world the profound gift of reimagining. By rendering reality in fragments, glimpses, lyric reveries, and narrative pulses, she has opened up her own experience with tremendous generosity and compassion to illuminate how difference is a place of endlessly generative passion. This book is a poetic love song as big as the cosmos. This book brings me back to life. Please join us for our conversation with Zaji Cox, which is already in progress. Zaji, thanks for joining us today back in the KBOO studios.
Yay, thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here, and it's my first time here too, so this is really awesome to be here.
Yeah, one of my first times since the pandemic, so we're both grateful to be here. Now, the subtitle of Plums for Months is a memoir of nature and neurodivergence. Mm-hmm. Let's get to the nature part first.
Yeah.
When you were a young girl, I think around 7, you moved along with your mother and older sister from New Mexico to an old house, 110 years old, in Gresham, Oregon. The house is owned by your mom's father and located on 2 acres, where blackberries, blueberries, grapes, apples, and plums grow wild. Yeah. That must have been quite a shift, especially at your age, from desert to the lush wilderness Gresham in your backyard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we actually moved there when I was like, I think it was the summer I turned 4, I want to say. So, I mean, it was even when I was pretty young, when I had that like shift from dry, hot desert air to like the lush greenery of the Pacific Northwest. And yeah, that definitely was like one of the founding, the basis of my youth and growing up.
That's quite a shift.
In nature.
That was Albuquerque in New Mexico?
Albuquerque, yeah. Oh. Yeah. I've always loved nature, like for as long as I can remember, too. So just experiencing both extremes, I guess, of nature, too. That was definitely, I feel like it was really meaningful to me, too. I've always been really comfortable in nature, like kind of more comfortable with nature and animals than with people. I'm a little...
I don't think you're alone there.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, sometimes I'm a little embarrassed to admit that, but I feel like some people will agree with that, too. But, yeah.
Now, there's a brief essay early in the book called What We Are, and you write of your ancestry and that of your sister. In the two of us, I'm quoting, we are many, Irish, Danish, French, German, Native American, Black, White, and more that we don't know. And you go on to describe how people squint at your sister and ask, what is she? Mm-hmm. And your classmate draws a picture of you and your sister and colors you the darkest, quoting here a chocolate brown. Mm-hmm. So that made for other differences, never feeling like you fit in both in New Mexico and Oregon?
Yeah, oh, definitely. Yeah, for as long as I can remember, I've always had this feeling of, you know, not fitting into like all the different little, like, I guess, for lack of a better word, boxes, I guess, or categories or sections that we consciously and subconsciously usually will set for ourselves. And
especially school age.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like we do that, you know, quite a lot when we're growing up and like learning a lot more about ourselves and how we interact with each other and, like, you know, in our friend groups and stuff like that. But yeah, it was definitely a more challenging part of growing up too, because, you know, I wanted all my friends to like me, but running into that issue with, like, oh, is that how my friends see me? Like, I'm just this specifically the token dark-skinned friend of the group.
It's almost like you're mixed race, but they had to pick a race to
exactly
which race box, in a way, of putting exactly. you in, and yep. they chose chocolate brown, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Yep, yeah, the darkest one. I'm the dark friend. Like, yeah, it was hard, but yeah, that was just the way it was. And back then, I wasn't super, like, I didn't feel super hurt by it back then. I was like, oh, that's weird, and I feel uncomfortable, but not knowing completely why I felt uncomfortable. I just knew that I didn't really like it that much. But then later on, you know, I understood, like, oh, it's because I was the kind of token dark-skinned friend in the friend group. And yeah, they just had to choose, like, I was one or the other. And yeah, just one of the problems that came with, or one of the challenges, rather, coming right. with being mixed race.
Oh, we'll get into those challenges. The second part of the book, subtitle, and it's not just a memoir of nature, but of neurodivergence. Mm-hmm. The term was introduced, I did a little research, just 25 years ago, oddly enough, by a sociologist, mm-hmm. Judy Singer. And rather than label people as normal or abnormal, which I guess they were doing before, the objective was to acknowledge that some brains work differently mm-hmm. than others. And that can result in different challenges. You contributed an essay, Navigating the Social Waves, to an anthology that came out during the pandemic called 2020, The Year of the Asterisk. Mm-hmm. You write, I'm quoting, "Since I was very young, I have felt unmeshed
yes.
with society." Could you talk about that feeling and those challenges
yeah.
You faced dealing with it?
Oh, totally. Yeah, ever since I can remember, I've always felt like my brain works differently from other brains. And on a certain level, everyone's brain works differently from everyone else's brain. But yeah, I feel like too, in recent years, the word neurodivergence has become a lot more widely used, which I think is great. You know, I feel like we've gotten a lot more aware of, you know, people with ADHD, people with autism, people on the autism spectrum, which I identify with. And I feel like this is definitely a very good thing because we're learning more about these things, about how people's brains are wired differently. Growing up, though, this was definitely something I had to kind of navigate in school.
You felt it was you.
And things. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, everybody yeah. else was kind of on the same wavelength. And
yep.
you were somewhere else and you didn't yeah. know what the problem was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like there's a piece in my book in Plums for Months where I talk about that in middle school especially. Mm-hmm. And this was part of the reason I had to come out of middle school is because that's kind of where I started to realize, oh, this is where, like, everyone else is kind of like on this certain level of understanding and I'm not really getting what the inside joke is or what the, like, all of these conversations everyone is having. I'm not really getting what the extra layer is, you know, underneath all of these conversations everyone's having. Like, I just didn't get what else is going on. Like, I always felt like there was some inside joke that everyone else was in on that I just was not a part of. And I felt like that all the time, and I just couldn't get why. yeah.
And of course, that's the challenges we just talked about, but there are strengths, mm-hmm. Which you talk about in your book, too. A common condition for someone who's neurodivergent, and you mentioned it, is autism spectrum disorder, sometimes called Asperger's. And I mm-hmm. think that was actually an essay called Asperger's mm-hmm. syndrome in your book. I think that was your diagnosis. It's a high-functioning autism, and there's a who's who mm-hmm. of people who have it. Musicians like James Taylor, Courtney Love, Bob Dylan even, climate activist Greta Thunberg, even entrepreneurs like Bill Gates and mm-hmm. Elon Musk, who I don't hold up as,
right.
but the other people are yeah. fine. In that same essay, Navigating the Social Waves, you wrote, "With the exception of close family, I looked up at most adults with confusion. Why were they trying so hard to be the same as each other? And what was more, why did they often mistake their tendencies for originality?" It seems when someone is neurodivergent, they can accept that they're different from others at some point, maybe even embrace it. And that leads to a truer originality.
Yeah, that's definitely very interesting. Interesting way of looking at it. And I do like that. And yeah, when I was younger, I would always look up at even teenagers too, but adults. And I would always wonder why they had this very specific way of speaking and these certain lilts in their voice and all these little mannerisms that always resembled what everyone else would do. And like, oh, why did this person say this sentence in this very specific way that mirrored what that other person said, like, you know, all
they're
these
trying
things.
To fit in, like, exactly. and they managed to do it, but a neurodivergent person, I guess, just says, you know, there's no way I'm going to fit in, so I'm just going to be me.
Yeah, and I just didn't understand why they wanted to do that, and yeah, my brain just didn't work that way, and like, it was taxing after a while. It was exhausting just to notice all of these similarities, and I guess I did understand why everyone kind of wanted to feel the sense of camaraderie and wanting to fit in with each other too. But after a while, I was just like, I want to speak differently and weirdly and be strange and awkward and weird. But then, yeah, it came with its own set of challenges too. But yeah.
Well, there's an essay in the book, The Five Senses, where you write, I have a feeling my senses work differently than others do. To take one example, you mentioned that you see paintings in your head when you listen to your favorite songs. And I've read that's similar to the experience of musicians like Billie Eilish, John Mayer. Mm. They see colors and shapes in their heads when listening to music. John Mayer said he doesn't regard it as a disorder, but a gift. A gift I think you also have. How does that affect your art, like dancing and writing? You're experiencing those things in different ways than what's a neurotypical person might.
Yeah, I do actually really like it. It's, to my knowledge, it's called synesthesia, where you like, you like mix the senses up and you like, you see sounds or you smell colors or things like that.
Exactly.
Yeah, I do enjoy that. The one I like most is when I see songs or I see the paintings in my head that come about when I listen to certain instrumentations. I've actually drawn pictures of some of my favorite songs.
Which you're seeing in your head as you're listening?
Exactly. Yeah. Like I remember in high school, I took out my sketchbook and I just decided to start drawing this Green Day song that I really liked. And
I think I wrote that down. I forgot what the song was, but it was about walking. Was that it?
I think so. Yeah, I think that's the one. Boulevard of Broken Dreams. Yeah, that Green Day song. Yep. Yeah, I still have that picture too. But that definitely comes in handy when I'm like trying to choreograph a piece or when I'm just doing, even when I'm doing like improvised dance, I'll listen to a song and then I'll just like, sometimes I'll just sit still and I'll listen to the song and I'll see motions in my head, first of all.
Wow.
And
then just to do that as part of your dance.
Yeah, that's what helps me when I'm like doing improv dance. Is I'll just like think about it and I'll imagine what's happening in my head. And then I'll like, if I'm making videos for my social media, I'll like click record on my phone and then I'll start moving around and like doing dancey stuff too. So yeah, that's all. Use that.
Now, my last interview for the show was with Keisha Josie Fisher, who you know.
Yeah.
And she wrote the story collection, No God Like the Mother. Now, she grew up in Nigeria and then moved to the U.S. to the Bay Area, and you were raised here in Portland. But you both share a passion to create. Keisha started writing stories in high school, but you were precocious. You started even earlier writing your first short story when you were 9 years old. Do you remember the story, Zaji, and what it felt like to put that creative urge on paper?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I think I remember like the day I started writing it. It's actually in my second self-published book.
Musings, right?
Yes. Yeah. It's this story about a squirrel, a little squirrel who is learning how to cross a telephone wire. Yes. So, yeah, he's like really nervous about like learning how to do that. It's basically like a rite of passage or like a coming of age type of story. And he's being taught by his parents how to cross a telephone wire because that's a part of life. It's a part of being a squirrel.
Being a squirrel, you got to do it.
Exactly. Yeah. So
it's like a driver's license.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just like you got to learn how to do it if you want to grow up. But yeah, so I remember the day I'm pretty sure that the day I started writing it is I was sitting in on one of my sister's dance classes, I want to say. And yeah, I just had my notebook with me and I was just like writing random stuff. And I was like, you know, I'm going to put this one idea that I've had to paper. And yeah, I just started writing that. And yeah, that's just kind of how that came to be.
Now, when Keisha started writing, she said she was influenced by, in high school, of course, so mm-hmm. you were much earlier, reading Ursula K. Le Guin. Her teacher had given her the book, The Left Hand of Darkness. Mm. Keisha said, granted, I do not write science fiction, but I did learn from Le Guin that it was possible to create new worlds from nothing mm. and escape the real one anytime I choose. Your first book that you self-published was an adventure story for young readers. It was titled Journey to Argyrelia. Is that how it's pronounced?
Yeah, I say Argyrelia, but you know.
Argyrelia. Well, we got to ask the Argyrelians how they pronounce it.
Yeah.
Would you describe it's a world of pirates, gatekeepers, and endless oceans?
Yeah.
How did this new world come about, and was it your escape from
yes,
the real one?
Definitely. Yeah, it was so fun to write that story. Like, I started being homeschooled after I came out of middle school. And at the end of each, like, kind of homeschool day lesson, that was, like, my reward for myself was to go work on my story and, like, work on my book. Like, oh, I can go back to Argyrelia, basically. That was, like, my escape. And, yeah, I had so much fun writing that story because that was more or less my way of like going from this world to the other world of like, you know, pirates and sailing and ships and all these adventures that these three friends got into. Because basically it's a story about these three best friends who fall into another world and one of them gets kidnapped by pirates and then the other two have to go find her and rescue her and then try to figure out how to get back home. And yeah, it was definitely inspired by a lot of other stories that I really liked to read, like Chronicles of Narnia, of course, and Indiana Jones. There was some Indiana Jones references in there, too. And Pirates of the Caribbean, of course. That was
You mentioned Disneyland in the book.
Yes.
You said that you were inspired actually by, I think it was in one of your classes before homeschooling, mm-hmm. there was a book of essays, and there was one on Splash Mountain.
Yes.
And you were just amazed how they captured the feeling of mm-hmm. actually being somebody on the ride Splash Mountain.
Yes.
And you were a Disneyland lover, as a lot of us are.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, Disneyland was like one of the founding places of my youth, more or less. Yeah, we tried to go whenever we could afford it. And Disneyland absolutely contributed to my sense of adventure and fantastical thoughts and storytelling and all that fun stuff. But yeah, reading that essay in that book that we got in middle school, because we were doing like a section on creative writing in my language arts class, and our teacher gave us these books to read, and we had to read this little sample from some anonymous writer as an example. I'm like, this is how you would describe, how you would use descriptive words in like an essay. And it was like the most amazing thing I had ever read, because I was like, oh my gosh, I've ridden that ride and this is exactly how I felt. Whoa. And like my mind was blown at the time, because I was like, I didn't know that you could basically describe
communicate
that kind of thing.
Your thoughts
exactly.
and your feelings in mm-hmm. writing like that to other people.
Yeah, and that was like, I guess that's like the way the door was opened, more or less. It's like, oh, this is something I can do with words. Like, I can communicate my passion about something or like my feelings about something to people through word magic. It felt like magic to me. Like, I had goosebumps when I was reading it. Like, it was a whole thing. It was awesome. I love that book.
And that book, of course, we mentioned was self-published, and you have a nice essay mm-hmm. in the book about picking up the copies at Portland State University Bookstore.
Yes.
I think in those days they had the espresso book machine, something like that, which printed and bound mm-hmm. copies, something like that. And then your second book also was self-published, Musings, which we mentioned. And again, to go back to Keisha, she self-published her first book also, which led to her meeting Laura Stanfill and publishing the book with Forest Avenue Press. How did you first connect with Laura, and what were the origins of this book?
Oh, man. Yeah, Laura is awesome.
Yes, she is.
She's so great. Yeah. We met at a garden party, actually. Yeah, it was awesome. We, a mutual friend who we knew, I knew her through the corporeal writing community, and corporeal writing is a...
Oh, yes. I want to ask you about that, too, after we talk about Laura.
Yeah.
And the head of that, of course, is Lydia Yuknovich.
Lydia, yeah. She's just awesome, too. So we knew mutual friends through that writing community. And, yeah, we met at this garden party, and we just started talking a lot about various things. I honestly don't remember, like, everything we talked about, because we just talked for a really long time. But we just talked about, like, you know, being a woman in the writing industry, and just, like, she talked to me about what it was like being a publisher, and I just talked a lot about, like, the things I like to write about, and, like, the things I would like to write about, and then just, you know, other various stuff, too, like, not even about writing, but just about life and all sorts of things. And
did you have the book in mind at that point, Plums for Months?
No. The way the book even started was I didn't see it as like a finished product. I just had to get like these stories about this house onto paper. Yeah. And then eventually after a while, after I'd written enough of these like little short essays, that's when I was like, okay, maybe I should put this all together in like a collection or something like that. Like I didn't even have a finished product in mind. And then after Laura and I like kind of knew each other for a while, she sent me an email and she was like, how would you prefer like to self-publish this, or would you be okay with, you know, being represented by Forest Avenue Press? And I was like, that never happens, to have someone reach out to
she
you.
She must like, have been impressed by you, because she has the best taste in literature of anyone
she
I know.
Oh my God. Yeah. I was so like taken aback, and I was just so flattered, and I was so shocked, and just like, oh my gosh, I felt all of the things. It was amazing. Yeah.
Now, the initial title for the book was The House Itself, which we talked about, that Gresham House, 110 years old. Of course, it plays a huge part in the book and your childhood. But you changed it at some point, I think within the last year or so, before it came out, to Plums for Months, which is taken a phrase taken from the essay, A New Almost Home, when you describe the fruit growing wild in your backyard. Why the title change?
Yeah, originally it was going to be The Gresham House. Just that was its working title, and it just stayed like that because I felt like it was appropriate. And
oh, yes.
Yeah, definitely representative.
It's the star of the book.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that's what we always called it when we talked about the house and that area and like that life, basically. It was just like, oh, yeah, back at the Gresham House. Yeah. But then Laura was saying that, you know, maybe some people who aren't from around this area who might read the book, they might not know where Gresham is. And so just to communicate like what might be a better alternate title that will communicate the essence of the book, but will be a little bit more accessible to people who aren't native to Oregon or familiar with the Pacific Northwest.
They might know plums, but they might not know Gresham.
Exactly. Yeah. Like everyone knows what plums are. But yeah. And so we brainstormed a lot. I think it was just all via email too. What will carry like the essence of the book, and what will represent like a lot of the abundance that we felt through the nature of the house.
Yeah, just
itself.
Growing wild back there.
Exactly. Yeah, and all sorts of things grew in the yard, and we were able to just like harvest whatever we could, and like either just like eat blackberries like directly from the vine, or like bake stuff with the blueberries that we picked from the vine. You know, all sorts of things like that. And so we were just trying to think like what would communicate that idea that we could maybe use to like represent the book as a whole. And yeah, we just chose that line, Plums for Months.
And a great cover, another great cover by Gigi Little.
Yes. Oh, I love that
cover. I think is one of the best book cover designers there is.
She's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And even before you started writing, you were very creative always. And you expressed some of that, those new worlds inside you in gymnastics. You started practicing when you were 7, which incredibly is considered getting a late start for a competitive gymnast. Yeah. You think of Nadia Comaneci. I think she was doing cartwheels at the age of 1 week or whatever. But but you threw yourself into it. So you were practicing at the gym 3 days a week, 4 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And you did that for about 7 years, then focused more on your writing and dance now. Mm-hmm. Why did you leave gymnastics? What was missing for you?
Yeah, I mean, I loved gymnastics. Like, it felt like definitely, I mean, it was the foundation of my athleticism, honestly. And, you know, most people will start doing things like that when they're like 3 or 4 years old. And then I felt like a late bloomer in that area because I started when I was 7. So I already kind of had that with me as I was going through gymnastics. But, you know, still, I definitely felt very accomplished as I went on, like in competitions, especially. I was really good at bars. I think that was my best event. And I got first place at a few different competitions. And I always felt super accomplished there. And my dance elements, and when I competed on floor, those were always like the things I felt super proud of as well. And I was always super flexible and like all these really great things about gymnastics. But the one thing that always, it didn't always hold me back, but I always felt kind of hesitant about was just the aspect of competition. I loved that my team were all very supportive of one another and we always relied on each other, like, oh, my friend is super good at vault, and so we'll can always rely on her for a good vault score to support the rest of us for this competition. And, you know, Zaji's super good at bars, and so we can rely on her for a good bar score, you know, stuff like that. And I loved that kind of, like, team energy. But I just felt super anxious about competition and scores and numbers all the time. You know, there's nothing wrong with that in gymnastics, too. Like, it's, for a lot of people, you know, competition is great, and it helps build you as a person. It helps you, like, become better than the you that you were yesterday, you know, that sort of mentality. I love that mentality because it helps you grow as a person.
So, yeah, how did that translate to writing and dance? Mm-hmm. I know the discipline must yes. have really taken part, and yeah. then, of course, dance, the physical aspects of it, athletically. Mm-hmm. But were there other aspects of gymnastics that kind of made you a better writer or a better dancer?
Yeah, definitely. That self-discipline, absolutely. I feel like I'm still very self-disciplined in a way. And my sister really helped with that, too. She was my coach for a long time in gymnastics.
She seems like the best sister anybody could ever have.
Yes, she's awesome. Shout out to you, Bevan. No, yeah, she's really great. And yeah, she was definitely a very positive influence on my growing up. And, you know, even though she did the big sister things, like tease me a lot and, you know, stuff like that, classic big sister stuff. But she was always very loving, very protective, and all that good stuff.
Yeah, in fact, your whole family, mother, father, of course, your mm-hmm. sister, always seemed very loving and supportive of everything you did, gymnastics, yeah. writing, dance. Even though your parents were divorced, your mom later remarried, you even lucked out with a great stepfather, yeah. From what I read in the book. I've interviewed several writers of memoir, and I got to tell you, a loving, supportive family is not all that common.
Right.
It reminds me of the Tolstoy quote, "All happy families are alike, but each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way." I think that's how Anna Karenina starts out.
Right.
But I think plums for months can be an argument against that right. line. I mean, I think you described it once as almost a fairy tale of childhood. Mm. Of course, there were ups and downs, a lot of downs, as you mentioned, because right. you were different, mm-hmm. not always accepted in school and other parts of society. Mm-hmm. But your family seemed to be always there for you and very supportive. And I just love reading that.
Yeah.
It's nice to know that there are totally. Families like that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And, you know, that's one of the things I'm definitely very grateful for. I know that that doesn't always happen. But yeah, that's one of the things I really wanted to highlight, too, is just that we always had our unit of three living in that house. Five, if you count our two cats. But, you know, me, my mom, and my sister, we were always, always there for each other and could count on being there to support each other. And we had our ups and downs, of course, like families have. But, yeah, we were there. And, you know, after a while, my dad did move from New Mexico to Portland, too. And so he lived in Portland while we lived in Gresham. And so he was also there for me, too.
Oh, you mentioned he was part of the homeschooling for you, too, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah. He supported me in that, too. And, yeah, I spent time with him as well. And, yeah, so he's always been there to support me from whatever distance he was at too. So yeah, I'm definitely very grateful to have that. I know it's not always extremely common, but yeah, my family's really wonderful, and I'm so grateful to have them.
Now let's talk about another wonderful person. We mentioned her before, Lydia Yuknovich.
Yes.
You have a great blurb on the cover of Plums for Months from Lydia. And you also took classes from her, workshops at her Corporeal Writing Center in Portland. I should also mention that you'll be in conversation with Lydia for your PALS event next week, the book launch, which is big time.
Yes.
And how did the corporeal writing workshops help you in your writing and Lydia's guidance?
Oh my gosh, in so many ways. I always say this to my mom, but I have my mom to thank because Lydia was one of her and my sister's teachers back in the day, back when she taught at, I think, Mount Hood Community College.
That's right. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Then she moved out, I think, to SDSU and then came back here.
Yeah. Yep. Uh-huh. Yeah. She taught them. And yeah, my mom, after a lot of years, she's like, you know, you should take one of Lydia's writing workshops. She's really amazing, and I think you would benefit from it. And she told me that for like years, and I was like, "Hey, well, Mom, don't worry. Sometime soon." I just kept like kind of saying that every time. But eventually, yeah, I took one writing workshop. I think it was in like 2019, I want to say. It was definitely a few years ago, but yeah, I took one. I think it was like the summertime workshop. I can't remember exactly what it was called, but it was a summer workshop. And yeah, I took that, and that was just like the way it all started. And yeah.
Now, I've talked to her a few times about her own writing, most recently for her novel Thrust, which I think is the best works of fiction written in the past few years. I mean, I absolutely love the book. In one of our conversations, I asked Lydia about her writing process. She said, "I write in literary fragments, period. And sometimes those fragments find a place to resolve or a place to hold attention open. And those are short stories. Sometimes those fragments go on in my work and they turn into novels. I can't help but think that influenced Plums for Months, which is made up of fragments, these brief essays, poems, even some photos, some pictures of cats, which find a place to resolve in the book. Is that something you got out of Lydia and corporeal writing?
Yeah, definitely. That's not something I like thought of before, at least not in the forefront of my mind. But now that you say that, that actually makes sense. Yeah, I do like to, at least for this book, I definitely do like to kind of put things together from pieces or from fragments, because that's how I remember a lot of things, too. Usually, at least one thing I've read recently about like how the autistic brain works is we notice a bunch of details at first, and then we see the big picture versus, I guess, how neurotypical brain works is like the opposite. Like, they'll... Most people will see like the big picture first, and then they'll notice like the details.
So seeing the forest, a neurotypical might see the forest first, and then the individual trees. Where neurodivergent, you would see this tree, this tree, this tree, and oh, it's a forest.
Yes, yeah, and I didn't really think about that before, but that makes complete sense. Uh-huh. And now that's like making
and those are the fragments. The trees are analogous there.
You're
creating the forest.
Yeah, yeah, and I didn't even realize that about my own brain until I read this online recently. But like, yeah, that makes me realize that, yeah, a lot of my writing is based on these little fragments that I would just like jot down randomly one day and then like forget about. And then I'll like, you know, open my notebook the next week or something like that. And then I'll be like, oh yeah, this was just like this little piece of some story that could exist as like a bigger work or a bigger thing.
That sounds exactly like Lydia's process.
You know, maybe it is. Yeah.
You're on the same wavelength there, at least, or maybe that was something that she taught, you picked up from her work classes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why I like workshops too, is because they'll, you know, you'll have a prompt or a portal, as they call it. They call them writing portals, which I really like because it is like a portal, like into a different world. But yeah, you'll get these little like prompts or these inspirations, and you can like write for as long as you have like a couple minutes or whatever, and then you have that little like piece of whatever you created, and then you can either do nothing with it and that's fine, or that can build into something else. But either way, that's just like a little fragment that you can just start from.
And again, that seems exactly what she was saying in that quote.
Yeah.
Yeah, just seeing where the fragments lead her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's awesome.
Now, Zaji, you published an essay last year for the online site Cultural Daily. Mm. It's called When the Self Has Gone and describes an event, which you say with a capital E, that happened for the first time several years ago when you were at college. You had the first of several seizures at the time, and that presented you with yet another challenge. Now, I'm asking not only out of curiosity, but my oldest son also has suffered from occasional seizures. Mm-hmm. And you know, we've been through it. It's such a mystery what causes them and how to treat it. What's it like for you? Is it always there for you, the possibility that there might be a seizure?
Yes.
That's a difficult way to live. And I know there's medication that can control it, but not necessarily successfully all the time.
Yeah. And honestly, it really helps me to like be able to talk about it with people too, because then it's not just like this secret struggle that I have. But
well, we learned it's not that uncommon either.
It is. It's so weird. Like I learned recently, well, not recently, but a while after I had that first one, that it's something that can happen to people around that same age that I was, because I was like in my younger 20s when I just randomly started.
That's when it happened
started.
To my son, yes.
That's so
younger
weird.
20s. I had no idea what caused it, why it came about at that time.
And that'll just happen to people. And it's like, I did not welcome this into my life. Please don't happen again. Like what? It's just so weird. Yeah, but... Yeah, it is definitely, you know, it's unfortunately like a fear that I'll have, but it's not something that'll prevent me from trying to like go on and live life to the fullest, for lack of a less cliched term. But yeah, you know, it's definitely a difficulty to, because you just don't know when it's going to happen again or anything like that. But thankfully, it's helped me want to write about it.
Yes, I was going to ask that, because it's not in Plums for Months, because probably the manuscript was already done by then, or it's a certain part of your life. Mm-hmm. The seizures happened after that. But is that something you're going to write about and expand on in current work?
That is something I have thought of. Yeah, because I wanted to write about it in an essay, just because writing about things helps me work through them, or I want to be able to write about things like that, just to connect with other people in case anyone else has experienced something like that. I like to help other people not feel alone, you know, things like that. But yeah, that is definitely something I was thinking of writing more about, because I did actually have, for the first time in like 7 years or so, I did have another episode recently.
What was that like? I know when my son has them, they come on pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. There's a few signs if you can interpret them.
Yes.
And then, you know, by the time you're conscious again, you might be in bed somewhere, or sometimes in the hospital.
Yeah, it's been in all kinds of different situations for me in the past, but this recent one, since it's happened so many times, I was able to identify exactly when it was happening. I knew what caused it, but I am on anti-seizure medication.
Yes, yes.
And so that has helped in the past. It's helped them not be, I guess, as intense. But yeah, I was able to kind of identify like the
precursors to
exactly.
It. What were they? Was it kind of colors, a feeling, a dizziness?
It's a feeling. Like it's kind of hard to explain, honestly, but like it's this weird like fuzziness in my brain, and it like starts and like the sides of my brain, and then it just like kind of starts to like take over like the rest of my head. And like in the past, I've been able to just like kind of calmly like take deep breaths and like prevent it from happening in a way.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, like in a way, like I've been able to kind of keep it from like kind of coming on. Mm-hmm. But also there have been times where I'm not able to really do that, like this time recently where it happened. And so when I do feel it coming on, I was by myself. And so what I was able to do was just kind of get down onto the ground and then make sure I was like on my side, because you don't want to be on your back when you're having a seizure.
Right.
So I was able to like get down on the ground, and I was like, okay, well, hopefully this doesn't happen. But if it does, I'm in a safe spot. And then next thing I knew, I was opening my eyes and I was like, oh, dang it. It happened again. No, I was on such a good streak. But
well, hopefully the medication will get it under control at some point. Mm-hmm. I know it takes a while.
It does. Yeah. I know. Yeah. I did let my newish doctor know about it too. And so I do actually have an appointment with a neurologist, a seizure specialist, which is great.
Yes.
So.
And we went through the same thing. Yeah.
Oh,
and again, there's a lot of things they don't know, mm-hmm. but there's still advancements made.
Yes.
And like I said, it's not uncommon.
Yeah, which I'm glad about, too, because it's a really scary thing.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. It's so scary, especially that first time. Like, and if you don't have, like, any history or any, like, other telltale signs, or if it's not, like, hereditary, you just don't know why it happens. It just
does. We have no idea, yeah, with our son.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's something a lot of the neurophysiologists or the doctors aren't that interested in, even what causes it. They want to know how to treat it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of like if you're a physicist, I have no idea how the universe started. It's a Big Bang, but what was before the Big Bang? We don't know. So we're going to skip that part.
Right. It's like, what came first?
Right. So as long as they could treat it successfully, the source, the mystery of it may never be solved.
Yeah. This is crazy. Yeah. I thought it was like a gymnastics thing, because I also have this other weird thing with my vagus nerve, vasovagal syncope.
Oh, that you might have injured in gymnastics?
Yeah, or like I might have like triggered something, at least the first time it happened. Like I might have pinched that nerve unknowingly. Because if I do like a certain stretch, or if I like pinch my shoulder blades together and I pinch that nerve, I'll like pass out. So I thought maybe I did something weird like that to just like trigger the first one, which like set off a chain of events maybe, but I don't know. I don't know.
Now, Sanji, I want to go out with something you said in a previous interview, quoting, "I want to be able to, if there are people who feel similar ways, to let them know they aren't alone. There are other people who have felt these same ways as you did with mixed race, neurodivergence, and even with the seizures now. And you give this advice, stay true to yourself and represent who you are." I just wanted to go out with that and thank you for being here today.
Oh, thank you so much, Ken. I am so grateful to be here and like talk about all of these things, all of these things that I've kept to myself for so long. It's just been so great to be able to do that. So yes, I really appreciate it. And it's been great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KABU Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, or would like to hear the longer, unexpurgated version, the director's cut, you might call it if we had one, you can listen anytime on demand at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KABU website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Zaji Cox, author of the new book, Plums for Months, a Memoir of Nature and Neurodivergence, from Portland's Forest Avenue Press. Zaji will be launching the book in conversation with Lydia Yuknovich at Powell's City of Books in downtown Portland this Monday, May 15th at 7 p.m. You can learn more about Zaji, her work, and all her upcoming events online at Zaji, Z-A-J-I, theartist.com. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, May 25th at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying...
Synesthesia, by the way, is some people have a clinical, I don't know if I'd call it a disorder, it's a gift of sorts, whereby words and sounds actually are interpreted as colors in their brain.